there, it's Mary, and welcome to the final episode of Dogcast. Throughout this series, we've examined the inner workings of school support dog programs. We've discovered the remarkable roles these dogs can play and met the dedicated individuals behind their success. Today, we're joined by Sally Bannerman from the New South Wales Department of Education. In her role as school's animal welfare coordinator, Sally has been right in the mix, ensuring that school dogs across the state receive the best treatment possible. She's responsible for overseeing the school's Animal Care and Ethics Committee, which published the Support Dog Guidelines in 2021. The comprehensive framework was born out of extensive research, school visits and consultations with experts like guide dogs, dog behaviourists, veterinarians and, of course, the department's legal services. The guidelines apply to all schools in New South Wales and can be found on the Animals in Schools section of the Department of Education's website. In this conversation, Sally covers key aspects of the guidelines, including how often accredited trainers should visit schools and the maximum number of days support dogs can work. These insights have been particularly enlightening as I've contemplated whether to introduce a four-legged friend to my school. On that note, I've got some exciting news to share, so stick around till the end. But first, let's jump into my chat with Sally.
Hi, Sally.
Hi, Mary.
Thanks so much for having a chat to me today. I've been going around to a whole lot of different schools. I'm thinking of getting a dog for my own school, and I've been learning about the different ways that those schools use dogs. One of the things I have noticed is a lot of the principals have referred to the guidelines and that's assisted them when they've been thinking about getting a dog and then managing that process. Can you tell me a little bit about those school support dog guidelines?
Yeah, in my role as the animal welfare coordinator, I had a lot of requests from some directors and executive directors about some issues that had happened in their schools about the use of dogs. And they were concerned about the dog welfare and about the student welfare and about how staff were perhaps managing them. So they asked if there could be some quite objective guidelines to assist schools make sure they were doing the right thing. So based on that, I went to the school's Animal Care and Ethics Committee, and between some vets and some animal welfare experts and legal services, we drafted the guidelines, and now they're available and they must be adhered to by all schools. And the point of those guidelines is to provide some consistent advice for schools so that they kind of know what they can and can't do, and it makes it really clear and objective for them.
So you're using the term support dog, and I noticed that in some schools, some of the principals or staff referred to them as therapy dogs. Other people talked about well-being dogs. Can you explain a little bit about those different types of dogs and how the guidelines might apply to them? Are they different?
Yeah, it is a little confusing because different organisations, different people use different terms. So some people, as you said, say call them therapy dogs. Some people call them well-being dogs. There's a variety of terms. So we just tried to come up with one blanket term that would cover all those. Wherever a dog is being used to support a variety of people in the school setting. So we came up with this term school support dog. And one of the main things that schools need to understand is that these dogs, they're fantastic dogs. I'm not being disrespectful or degrading of them, but they're not assistance dogs. And those are very different dogs. Those are dogs like guide dogs, or dogs that are particularly trained to help people who are hearing impaired. And those dogs are trained to work with only one person. And the thing that really makes them stand out from what we know as school support dogs or therapy dogs is that they have a what we call a PAT, or they've passed a public access test, which is a high-level test. And that allows those dogs to go on things like aeroplanes, go into shopping centres, go to the theatre, go anywhere, go into national parks. And they're quite different, and they've reached a higher level of training, and they're particularly for people with particular disabilities, and they're covered by the Anti-Discrimination Act.
Okay, I actually met a dog that was training to be a guide dog at Guide Dogs Australia, mm-hmm. Who then had decided to instead become a support dog. Mm-hmm. Got being a guide dog was not for her. And I noticed though, apart from that dog, all of the other dogs that I have seen in schools have been owned by members of the staff, or apart from the story dog, which was owned by someone externally who would bring that story dog in. And the owners generally were also the handlers at the school, and they were adults. It seems like that successful kind of program, though, is a real team effort, that there has to be a primary handler for the dog, but there's also sort of the whole school community on board. Is that stuff described for me in the guidelines?
Yes. Well, how we've managed that is that the dog can't really be owned by the school. The dog needs to be owned by a person, because dogs are companion animals and they need a person or a family that they relate to and are their primary caregivers. And so that's why we've stipulated that they can't be owned by the school and just taken home on different occasions, or left on the school grounds, or, you know, kept in a kennel somewhere else. The Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act is quite clear, and it says that the dog must be managed and there must be a person who is at least 18 years of age to take responsibility for that dog. So it's really important that that primary handler is at least 18, so that legally they're covered to be the responsible person for that dog. In some schools, we occasionally see students who are very well trained with the dog and they've undergone a lot of training with a trainer and they've worked extensively with the dog. And in some schools, those students are allowed to take that dog out of, say, the principal's office without the principal at times. But in those cases, the principal or the person that owns that dog has legally taken responsibility and has put in writing that if anything were to happen while the student has the dog, that they will be responsible. So it really is, it sounds boring, but it's important that there are those clear lines of responsibility, because we don't want to put anybody at schools at risk.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed that I was quite fascinated by this is that the principals or the staff members who owned the dog, there was a very close relationship between them, but then a real change in the dog when they put on these bandanas or little vests that they wore, which kind of indicated that they were now at work. I'm just wondering about, tell me more about that. What's the, why do they wear those?
Yeah, it's a quite an important part of dog training. And you see it when you have guide dogs have their harnesses on, when you see them out in public. And when you see a guide dog that when it goes home and it takes its harness off, their behaviour changes quite dramatically. They become more playful, and it's kind of like they've taken their work hat off and they've taken on a more leisurely role. And it's the same for a school support dog. When they put their vest on or their bandana, then they go to work. And it's like us putting on our work clothes compared to hanging around in our pyjamas, in our slippers. And it also, when the dog is wearing a bandana or a vest, it also tells the school community that this isn't just a dog that's wandered in off the street or someone's brought it in for some other reason. It's actually part of the school community and it's at work that day.
So I feel like I'm getting closer and closer now to really making this dream of having a dog in my school, a support dog in my school, become reality. Are there compliance documents that I can find online? What do I need to do before I formalise this?
One of the most important things, and this is part of what's written in the Animal Research Act, is that every school needs to have an animal welfare liaison officer. And that's the person who takes the major responsibility for sort of overseeing the welfare of any animals that are used in that school. If that's a primary school, then the legislation stipulates that that must be the principal. if it's a secondary school, then it can be any other member of the staff that the principal deems is suitable. So in the case of a school that offered agriculture, it's most commonly the agriculture teacher. If that school doesn't teach agriculture but has a dog in their school, then it could be any other staff member that would take on that level of responsibility.
What would the principal be looking for to think about what deems someone appropriate to take on that role? You've said, obviously, I understand with the agriculture teacher, but does just owning a dog mean that you would be appropriate for that role?
Well, if the dog is the only animal that is in your school, then it's probably most appropriate that it's the main handler of the dog, because that person has probably done the training with the dog and has gained some additional skills. So you're looking for someone who doesn't have to be the encyclopedia of dogs, but has a greater awareness and knowledge than perhaps a lot of other people in the school might have, and is prepared to take that level of responsibility.
Okay. Are there any other things that I would need to be aware of?
Yes, then they need to have completed their animal research authority every year, and that's sent out by the school sector. So if it's a public school, then it's sent out by the Department of Education. If it's a Catholic school, it's sent out by Catholic Schools New South Wales. And if it's an independent school, it's sent out by the Association of Independent Schools. And each year that comes out at the beginning of term two. There's also a copy available on the Animals in Schools website, and the school needs to complete that, and anybody who's working with the animals needs to sign that, and that includes staff or ancillary staff, anybody else. And that gets retained at the school, and it's basically your license to say that you can use these animals for educational purposes.
Is that a very onerous sort of process to do?
No. It's a very short, very just filling in the name, address of the school and the people signing.
Okay. All of the schools I've visited so far made it really clear that having the entire school community on board was vital to the Dogs in Schools program being successful in their school. Can you tell me a little bit more about how I can engage the school community?
I think you've made a great observation there, that it is really important that the whole school's on board, because the dog is around and the dog is interacting with a variety of students. And I think it's important to be mindful that some students or staff might be fearful of dogs, and they might also be allergic to dogs. So we need to make sure that all those people can be identified, and that we give them a little bit more space and we're respectful of their situation. It may also mean that someone who's fearful of dog wants to take that opportunity to overcome that fear and to become a little bit more comfortable around dogs. And so they can, if they identify, then they can do some work with that dog's handler and maybe, you know, enhance their quality of life. And I think it's also important, because everybody needs to be aware of the needs of the dog. The dog can't talk, but if the dog gets too stressed and the dog is feeling uncomfortable, then it's more likely to behave in a negative way or even be as fearful as to bite somebody, and we don't want that kind of thing to happen. So it's really important that the whole school's on board and that they've got the opportunity to make their thoughts about the matter clear.
Yeah, okay. You said before that dogs can't talk, but I have certainly met some students who would disagree with you because they've learnt to read the language of the dogs that they're working with. And one of the things that I was really very clear was that they could see when the dog needed to have a rest.
Mm-hmm.
And I, along the way, have picked up that it's only 3 days that a dog can be at school in a week.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me why that is? Why is that so important?
Yeah, because dogs by nature are adapted to sleep for long hours of the day. And if you have a dog of your own, you watch its patterns. They're generally very active in the morning, and then they sleep a bit more, and then they come active in the afternoon. And they very quickly balance themselves to what their family or their household is doing. So when a dog is at school, they're basically switched on and they're responding to that stimulus all the time. Mm. So they're very big days for a dog. And most people who have their dog coming to school will say on those dogs days that the dog doesn't come to school, they are very restful.
Yeah.
And they're often very tired when they go home after a day at school. And that doesn't mean to say that it's bad. You know, sometimes hard work and stimulus is really good for all of us. But we need to be respectful of that and give them days when they can switch off and they can be a dog not meeting the needs of other people. And also school dogs need to learn to stay at home too, because if you take them with you every day, then that can create, and they must be adhered to by all schools. And the point of those guidelines is to provide some consistent advice for schools so that they kind of know what they can and can't do, and it makes it really clear and objective for them.
So you're using the term support dog, and I noticed that in some schools, some of the principals or staff referred to them as therapy dogs. Other people talked about well-being dogs. Can you explain a little bit about those different types of dogs and how the guidelines might apply to them? Are they different?
Yeah, it is a little confusing because different organisations, different people use different terms. So some people, as you said, say call them therapy dogs. Some people call them well-being dogs. There's a variety of terms. So we just tried to come up with one blanket term that would cover all those. Wherever a dog is being used to support a variety of people in the school setting. So we came up with this term school support dog. And one of the main things that schools need to understand is that these dogs, they're fantastic dogs. I'm not being disrespectful or degrading of them, but they're not assistance dogs. And those are very different dogs. Those are dogs like guide dogs or dogs that are particularly trained to help people who are hearing impaired. And those dogs are trained to work with only one person. And the thing that really makes them stand out from what we know as school support dogs or therapy dogs is that they have a what we call a PAT, or they've passed a public access test, which is a high level test. And that allows those dogs to go on things like aeroplanes, go into shopping centres, go to the theatre, go anywhere, go into national parks. And they're quite different, and they've reached a higher level of training, and they're particularly for people with particular disabilities, and they're covered by the Anti-Discrimination Act.
Okay, I actually met a dog that was training to be a guide dog at Guide Dogs Australia, mm-hmm. Who then had decided to instead become a support dog. Being a guide dog was not for her. And I noticed though, apart from that dog, all of the other dogs that I have seen in schools have been owned by members of the staff, apart from the story dog, which was owned by someone externally who would bring that story dog in. And the owners generally were also the handlers at the school, and they were adults. It seems like that successful kind of program, though, is a real team effort, that there has to be a primary handler for the dog, but there's also sort of the whole school community on board. Is that stuff described for me in the guidelines?
Yes, well, how we've managed that is that the dog can't really be owned by the school. The dog needs to be owned by a person, because dogs are companion animals and they need a person or a family that they relate to and are their primary caregivers. And so that's why we've stipulated that they can't be owned by the school and just taken home on different occasions, or left on the school grounds, or, you know, kept in a kennel somewhere else. The Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act is quite clear, and it says that the dog must be managed and there must be a person who is at least 18 years of age to take responsibility for that dog. So it's really important that that primary handler is at least 18, so that legally they're covered to be the responsible person for that dog. In some schools, we occasionally see students who are very well trained with the dog, and they've undergone a lot of training with a trainer and they've worked extensively with the dog. And in some schools, those students are allowed to take that dog out of, say, the principal's office without the principal at times. But in those cases, the principal or the person that owns that dog has legally taken responsibility and has put in writing that if anything were to happen while the student has the dog, that they will be responsible. So it really is, it sounds boring, but it's important that there are those clear lines of responsibility, because we don't want to put anybody at schools at risk.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed that I was quite fascinated by this is that the principals or the staff members who owned the dog, there was a very close relationship between them, but then a real change in the dog when they put on these bandanas or little vests that they wore, which kind of indicated that they were now at work.
Hmm.
I'm just wondering about, tell me more about that. What's the, why do they wear those?
Yeah, it's a quite an important part of dog training. And you see it when you have guide dogs have their harnesses on, when you see them out in public. And when you see a guide dog that when it goes home and it takes its harness off, their behaviour changes quite dramatically. They become more playful, and it's kind of like they've taken their work hat off and they've taken on a more leisurely role. And it's the same for a school support dog. When they put their vest on or their bandana, then they go to work. And it's like us putting on our work clothes compared to hanging around in our pyjamas, in our slippers. And it also, when the dog is wearing a bandana or a vest, it also tells the school community that this isn't just a dog that's wandered in off the street or someone's brought it in for some other reason. It's actually part of the school community and it's at work that day.
So I feel like I'm getting closer and closer now to really making this dream of having a dog in my school, a support dog in my school, become reality. Are there compliance documents that I can find online? What do I need to do before I formalise this?
One of the most important things, and this is part of what's written in the Animal Research Act, is that every school needs to have an animal welfare liaison officer. And that's the person who takes the major responsibility for sort of overseeing the welfare of any animals that are used in that school. If that's a primary school, then the legislation stipulates that that must be the principal. If it's a secondary school, then it can be any other member of the staff that the principal deems is suitable. So in the case of a school that offered agriculture, it's most commonly the agriculture teacher. If that school doesn't teach agriculture but has a dog in their school, then it could be any other staff member that would take on that level of responsibility.
What would the principal be looking for to think about what deems someone appropriate to take on that role? You've said, obviously, I understand with the agriculture teacher, but does just owning a dog mean that you would be appropriate for that role?
Well, if the dog is the only animal that is in your school, then it's probably most appropriate that it's the main handler of the dog, because that person has probably done the training with the dog and has gained some additional skills. So you're looking for someone who doesn't have to be the encyclopedia of dogs, but has a greater awareness and knowledge than perhaps a lot of other people in the school might have, and is prepared to take that level of responsibility.
Okay. Are there any other things that I would need to be aware of?
Yes. Then they need to have completed their animal research authority every year, and that's sent out by the school sector. So if it's a public school, then it's sent out by the Department of Education. If it's a Catholic school, it's sent out by Catholic Schools New South Wales. And if it's an independent school, it's sent out by the Association of Independent Schools. And each year that comes out at the beginning of term two. There's also a copy available on the Animals in Schools website, and the school needs to complete that, and anybody who's working with the animals needs to sign that, and that includes staff or ancillary staff, anybody else. And that gets retained at the school, and it's basically your license to say that you can use these animals for educational purposes.
Is that a very onerous sort of process to do?
No. It's a very short, very just filling in the name, address of the school and the people signing.
Okay. all of the schools I've visited so far made it really clear that having the entire school community on board was vital to the Dogs in Schools program being successful in their school. Can you tell me a little bit more about how I can engage the school community?
I think you've made a great observation there that it is really important that the whole school's on board because the dog is around and the dog is interacting with a variety of students. And I think it's important to be mindful that some students or staff might be fearful of dogs and they might also be allergic to dogs. So we need to make sure that all those people can be identified and that we give them a little bit more space and we're respectful of their situation. It may also mean that someone who's fearful of dog wants to take that opportunity to overcome that fear and to become a little bit more comfortable around dogs. And so they can, if they identify, then they can do some work with that dog's handler and maybe, you know, enhance their quality of life. And I think it's also important because everybody needs to be aware of the needs of the dog. The dog can't talk, but if the dog gets too stressed and the dog is feeling uncomfortable, then it's more likely to behave in a negative way or even be as fearful as to bite somebody, and we don't want it, that kind of thing to happen. So it's really important that the whole school's on board and that they've got the opportunity to make their thoughts about the matter clear.
Yeah, okay. You said before that dogs can't talk, but I have certainly met some students who would disagree with you because they've learnt to read the language of the dogs that they're working with. And one of the things that I was really very clear was that they could see when the dog needed to have a rest.
Mm-hmm.
And I, along the way, have picked up that it's only 3 days that a dog can be at school in a week.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me why that is? Why is that so important?
Yeah, because dogs by nature adapted to sleep for long hours of the day. And if you have a dog of your own, you watch its patterns. They're generally very active in the morning and then they sleep a bit more and then they come active in the afternoon. And they very quickly balance themselves to what their family or their household is doing. So when a dog is at school, they're basically switched on and they're responding to that stimulus all the time. Mm-hmm. So they're very big days for a dog. And most people who have their dog coming to school will say on those dogs days that the dog doesn't come to school, they are very restful.
Yeah.
And they're often very tired when they go home after a day at school. And that doesn't mean to say that it's bad. You know, sometimes hard work and stimulus is really good for all of us. But we need to be respectful of that and give them days when they can switch off and they can be a dog not meeting the needs of other people. And also school dogs need to learn to stay at home too, because if you take them with you every day, then that can create a problem for you as the owner when you want to go to the theatre or go somewhere to visit a friend where you can't take your dog, then the dog has to stay at home. So
school.
The dog needs that and have to have their own space at home too.
School holidays would be quite problematic, I'd say, if your dog can't be left alone at home as well.
Yes.
So another thing that I noticed was that a lot of the schools, in fact, I think all of them, used a dog trainer prior to the dog coming to the school, and then that the trainer came into the school when the dog was sort of doing its orientation, I suppose. Why is that so important? And what can I do to make sure I've got a trainer for my own school support dog?
Trainers are really vital and they're an essential part of having a school dog. People who are dog trainers have got qualifications and experience in handling a variety of dogs in a variety of situations. And they can help you as the handler set you up to have a win-win situation. And it's better to start that earlier rather than later until, you know, we all make mistakes with our dogs, but it's better if those mistakes are a lot less.
Mm.
So get in with the trainer first and just start with the gentle things like socialisation, getting your dog used to different noises and different people. That dog trainer gives an objective view because we can all become blinded to our own dog and think that they're the most wonderful thing and make excuses for them. But someone coming from outside can be more objective and say, well, no, that's not appropriate. And also by getting a trainer on board, they can work with you and the school, so they can help other people at the school learn what the needs of your dogs are. And in the case of some schools, they work with the students and teach the students how to handle the dog. And like you said, how to read the language of the dog. So while the dog may not be talking as such, the dog's showing its behaviours, and then we need to read those behaviours. So the dog trainer can do that. And while some schools access online programs to help them, they can be valuable, but they don't actually interact with the dog. And that's what we need. We need a trainer that comes in, works with that actual dog, and works with that school, and then each year comes back and checks out the dog and makes sure that it's doing okay.
Ah, so it's not just sort of once the dog's there, that's the end of it. The trainer would come in and do some kind of monitoring.
Yeah. And that's required in the guidelines, that once a year someone comes, this trainer comes.